It's Saturday, May 9th, 2009, and you're listening to episode 146 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
My name is Pat.
And my name is Chris.
Ever since we have put the Fear the Boot forums up, we have had the same endless battle with spammers that pretty much every other forum and email box in the world has had. And we finally found a solution that seems to have stopped the spam, but unfortunately it seems to have stopped legitimate users as well. What we're doing is when you go to create an account, it will send you a confirmation email that has a link in it you're supposed to click to activate your account, which is more work than even a human spammer is generally willing to do. The problem is that for some reason, even though we're on a dedicated host, and I've checked all the blacklist sites and we're not blacklisted by anybody, a lot of email hosts are bouncing our emails back without delivering them. So here's what I want you to do. If you want to sign up for our forums, which I hope you do, it's a great community with great discussions, then go onto the forums, sign up. If that email does not arrive, go to the contact form that's linked off the main site, feartheboot.com, send an email to the general mailbox with the username that you picked on the forum, and we will manually activate you. Now, I know the obvious question is, Dan, you don't ever check the general mailbox, so...
And that still holds true.
So what's the point of doing this? And like Chad said, that still holds true, but the reason it still holds true is because in a pee or get off the pot situation, I have passed control of the general mailbox to Chad, who does actually check it. So your email will get read and your account will get activated in a timely fashion. So I've
been getting some interesting emails.
I can imagine. And I apologize for the slight inconvenience, but it's just the best we can do in this endless war against the spammers. March of Dimes?
Yes.
Doing really good. Last I checked, we're at about $900 of the $1,000. Chad has already posted pictures of himself bald on the forum.
I'm looking sexy.
He looks marvelous, by the way.
Thank you. I actually really like the new look. I think I'm going to keep the bald thing kicking. I like it.
You guys got about another $100 to go, and then I will lose my Samsonite power. I'm not talking about my luggage. I mean my hair. And then I will post pictures of that as well. Chris, you want to give a quick shout-out on the Skies of Glass artist submission again?
Yep, we're still taking art submissions for the Skies of Glass dramatic webcomic. I've had a couple questions so far just for some more background information for likely people who don't hang out in the forums. Just briefly, Skies of Glass is post-apocalyptic. No mutants, no magic, no weird stuff, just basic humans. I will put something extra together for that, but there is a link to character description document that is in the show notes for episode 145. So you'll just want to scroll down and find that there. And of course,
I'll just re-link it from these show notes again. So
you can, okay. And then submissions, of course, go to skiesofglass as one word at gmail.com. And if you have just additional questions about that, you can always get me at chris at feartheboot.com.
I want to kick around a question with you guys that flows quite naturally out of the past two episodes that we have had.
Like fine wine.
Because we talked about expanding horizons, trying new things, trying to make genres work that we struggle with internally, or in this particular case, one that I struggled with internally. And something of a debate sprung up on our forums and a couple
blogs. As it usually does.
And the question that I want to cover is this. Now, certainly, I will agree with what many people have said in response to those episodes. And I think to some degree they misunderstand who I am based on the limited knowledge you get from these shows. But nonetheless, the basic point is valid.
You mean you're a multifaceted and deep person beyond what you say on the mics for an hour each week?
Believe it or not, I am.
So you just don't shut down if the show is over, huh?
But one of the things that's been brought up is that there's a real virtue to trying new things, to saying yes. That if there's a genre that you've never tried before or you're not so sure it's going to work, it's better to say yes and maybe make some due diligence or some preparations, but to at least give it a shot.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there is a balance that we have to strike here, because there are some ideas that either A, are just legitimately bad,
yeah,
or B, maybe are not legitimately bad, but I've tried them, I've given them a fair shake, we've worked out the issues, and it's just not my thing. Mm-hmm. And the question that I want to pose to you guys is, how do you discern, or where do you draw the line for yourself or for the people in their gaming group between someone's just being closed-minded, needs to give something a fair try, and, okay, this is just either a bad idea or at least a bad idea for us, and maybe we either shouldn't do it or we should do it, but only with some heavy caveats?
The only circumstance I can think of offhand where you would want to say no, or maybe no with caveats, would be when it's a situation where you don't game very often. If you're not playing as much as you'd like to, your gaming time is really limited, and your prospects for gaming down the road, whether short or long term, aren't necessarily that good, you may not necessarily really want to try something new, something unfamiliar. You may want to stick with the familiar, stick with what you're comfortable with, because you know you can get enjoyment out of that. And I think that's okay. It's always good to step out of your comfort zone, but yet again, you know, this is a recreational activity, so you want to make sure what you do when you do it is always recreational. And with something new, you may not always get that.
You know what's strange is I would actually go the reverse route and say that if I had more limited gaming time, I think I would actually get more experimental.
Why do the same-o all the time?
Well,
not all the time, but...
Well, when you have so little, might as well try it all.
Right.
And on top of that, because I'm gaming less, I actually might feel a little less invested in it. You know, I don't game every single week. I don't have the same character. I can't count on the character being there next week. So might as well try something weird. And if it falls apart, well, we don't game that often anyway.
You know, and I see what you're saying. And in a certain sense, I do, you know, agree with you. But yet at the same time, you're kind of forgetting the learning curve that's usually involved with the new things, which can at times, at least in those first couple of sessions where you're getting your feet wet, take a little bit of the fun out of it because you're busy kind of struggling with the rules. And this, of course, goes in the assumption that everybody is new to whatever it is you're doing. You know, if there's somebody with experience sitting at the table, that's something different. But if everyone's new to it, it still may not necessarily be the most enjoyable activity to partake in.
I have actually been in that situation in the past in gaming where, you know, we would get together, try something new. Hey, this new game's out. Let's try playing it. Hey, sounds really cool. And we would start it, you know, 1 week we'd spend an entire session just rolling up characters, getting ready to play, and then maybe do something quickly and then come back the next time and do some more. And then it seemed like it petered out after about two sessions. At that point, we had just started and we never got into it. I remember I was really excited about trying those games because they sounded like fun. It's just that, unfortunately, my GM, I think he didn't like it. And instead of just saying no, it was always sort of just let it slide by the wayside. So I guess I'm sort of with Chris on that. And the fact that, you know, if you're going to try something like that, try to make a commitment to at least give it a fair shot, I think, not just let it peter out. Or on the other side, if you just hate it, come right out and say, no, I don't like this. Right. Let's do something else. Don't be wishy-washy about it.
Yeah. I think that if you have a string of losers, then I think that you should maybe not do the experimental stuff because, I mean, let's face it, tried and true works because it's tried and true. Experimental is just that. It's an experiment. It could work. It couldn't work. That's what's great about it is that you don't know, and it could be this new and exciting thing. But if you try something new and it doesn't work, that's okay. Then you try something else new and it doesn't work, well, that's okay. And then you try something else. Well, then you're starting to get a little demoralized. Like, eventually, yeah, you just want to have a nice game. New experiences be damned. I think you need to look at that. It's like, what is your group's tolerance for potential failure? And that's not to say all new or different games are failures, but I think you'll have a higher rate or higher chance of failures. You need to gauge your group's tolerance to that. Because honestly, for the most part, people don't like change.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. I think a group dynamic in general is that people are creatures of habit.
Yeah.
The reason you do things is because you do get comfortable with them. You know, you have habits, you have routines, whatever. Now, that's not to say you shouldn't try new things. I like to branch out a little bit. Hey, I'm as experimental as the next guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, I always do come back.
Your group isn't necessarily like
that. Right. Yeah. And I always come back to my base. Whatever I do, I mean, it's not, I'm not making wild 180 degree swings, mm-hmm. you know, whenever I do something. So those are things to keep in mind, I think, when you do try something new.
Yeah.
I think for me, and this is something that I would apply both to myself as well as to other people to determine whether this is a genuine no versus just a prejudice they need to get over. Did they try something fairly? If it didn't work, did they seek advice? Did they try to fix the problem? Did they try it from a couple angles and they're just not having fun with it? Then you know what? It may not just not be their thing.
Did they go into it courting disaster? Did they go right. into it expecting failure and created a self-fulfilling prophecy too? I think that's something you have to look for. Where that's really interesting too, when you have a group of people and you have everybody in the group wants to do this thing X, the new big thing, but one person doesn't. Is this the person who's going to go along with it, but he doesn't know, and then I don't know, and then he drags everybody down like an anchor, and then he's I told you so. Yeah, you kind of got to watch out for those people too. What do you do with people like that? What do you do with the group boat anchor, the no guy?
You know, this is probably not the most socially gracious advice I can give, but
we did an entire episode on how to sabotage games.
Yeah, well, the fruit of experience here mm-hmm. is you just do it anyway.
Let the boat anchor be a boat anchor. You keep sailing on.
Yeah, and basically you just say, look, I know you don't like this. We're going to game this for a couple weeks. We hope you'll join us. If you don't, we'll let you know when the next game starts.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, the person will try and they don't want to be left out, so they'll probably right. try and get involved. And they might sabotage it and be a jerk, but hopefully they won't.
I call that the tyranny of democracy. It's where you have one guy who hates something and then you have five guys who want to go for it. Tough. He's outvoted. It's yeah. not very fair, well, but just, I mean, you try and find consensus, but
it's just, you know, it's the majority rules kind of a thing. I mean, you know, just in general, in a small group, not everyone's going to agree 100% as much as you might think they will or would hope that they were. So you sort of go with the majority.
You know what I have to say on that?
I mean, I don't see that as a problem at all.
I think that when you have that guy who's the boat anchor and you do the tyranny of democracy thing where you say, okay, we're all friends here, but we all want to do this. So, and you really don't, we're going to do it anyway. Give a little bit to him. Maybe he likes to play a certain kind of character that you guys are down, or maybe he has this character idea that you guys are against him playing, or maybe he wants something that's kind of been tamped out, or maybe he wants, you want to play a certain kind of game, or he wants to play a certain kind of rule system, whatever. Take the big fight, but give him a piece, you know, give that negative guy a little something.
And also ask,
because everybody's got to be happy.
Ask some questions, because you will get a long way with people just by being courteous and by trying to understand them. If you say, look, we're going to play.
God, I've been doing it wrong all these years.
But you've been doing totally wrong.
But if you say, look, we're going to be playing Game X, and they say no,
mm-hmm.
why?
Right.
Why do you not want to play this? Well, I'm worried about this, this, and this. Okay, well, what if we did this, this, and this to try to resolve that and give them some sense they're being heard? And
yeah, don't take the tact of, well, why don't you like it? Well, A, B, and C. Well, you're just wrong. Yeah. You're just totally wrong. A, B, and C isn't even a factor. No. It's a dialogue. It's a at this point, you're negotiating.
It's a factor to them, therefore it's a factor.
Yes. And really, if it's like any gaming group I've played, rarely are you going to have five guys against one. It's going to be six individuals, and they all kind of tend towards one way, but it's just a tending. It's just a leaning, and they all have different opinions. And I actually enjoy this. There's a friendly negotiation. Don't look at the negotiations of what are we going to do? What are we going to play? Do we try this new thing? It's, oh man, here we go. It's the debate. Look at it as, okay, you have an agenda that you're putting on the table, and everybody else has their little points. Maybe it's like a big melting pot. Everybody can put their points in, and you can kind of stir it up a little and come out with something that is different than what you want to go in with. And you don't necessarily compromise everything down and get what nobody wants.
Which would be riffs every time.
Yeah. It'd be what? Riffs every time.
Well, yeah,
that is kind of the melting pot.
You get your sci-fi, you get your fantasy. You get
So we're shooting for stew.
Yes.
Okay, just so I'm clear.
RPG
stew. I love stew.
All right. I started a little query on our forums. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to get some insight from people. There was a topic that I've been wanting to chase on this show for a while, and I felt like I could do it some justice. It just felt like that there was too much information out there. There are too many ways of approaching this. Everyone's got their own technique. So I really wanted to get some insight from some other people on this. So in this topic we're going to talk about today, some of the stuff we came up with on our own. But I promised when I started the thread that I would give credit where it's due. So even on the stuff I thought of, if somebody else thought of the same thing, I'm going to credit a forum user for having thought of it. Also, sometimes multiple people came up with the same thing, and in those cases, I'm going to credit the person that said it first. So the topic we're talking about today is dungeon building. Now, I want to start off by setting some parameters here and saying, what do we mean by a dungeon? Because I don't want to just evoke the fantasy stereotype of what you go through in a game like Diablo, okay? This does not have to be the stereotypical dungeon from Dungeons & Dragons. I'm defining a dungeon as any terrain that requires a map outside of combat. Number two, something they are systematically, they being the players, something the players are systematically exploring, escaping from, sneaking through, or clearing out. Number three, it's got things like bad guys, traps, treasures, or objectives, the data core they have to recover.
So nouns.
Yeah.
You're talking about person, places, and things of role-playing games.
Well, yes, but specifically, once again, places that are detailed enough that they require an out-of-combat map. And this could be a cave, a castle, an office building, a starship, a wizard tower. This could be an outside town.
Could it be an igloo?
It could be an igloo.
Chicken coop?
It could be a chicken coop if you're playing the game of flying. But we're going to call them all dungeons for simplicity's sake.
My chicken coop is now a dungeon. And it's filled with monsters.
Monster chickens.
Well, normal chickens, but chickens are monsters.
They're monstrous.
They're monsters.
Those chickens have sharp talons.
Exactly.
That's just
it's
foul.
Okay. I have a bow staff.
We're just scratching at this
please
one.
Please proceed, Dan.
I know, Chad's ready to...
Quit clucking around.
Yeah, enough of these yolks.
Yeah, just, Chris, don't egg them on, please.
I know, we're just going to peck away at this topic till it's dead anyway. We're going to get Dan's feathers ruffled if we keep doing this.
I know, Chris, you're such a cop. All right.
God, I love puns!
So, why care? Everyone at some point in the role-playing crew, whether GMing or playing, gets taken through the dungeon. Okay, and the broad definition I gave, it doesn't matter if you're playing sci-fi, zombie horror, fantasy, at some point you get taken through the dungeon.
Oh my god, a starship is both a dungeon and a vehicle at the same time.
And here's a couple reasons why I think you guys ought to be careful in making sure that these dungeons are well designed. Because one of the things that I have noticed about dungeons in most games is, well, two things. First off, a lot of times they rarely make any sense.
Yeah. Like it's the underground wizard's cavern, and this is where he lives, and it's a huge labyrinth that takes weeks to traverse, and it's ultra dangerous. Well, how the hell does he live there?
Right. Well, and secondly,
how does anybody live there?
I find they're very jolting, where it seems to be the plot's going along. We go into the dungeon, and all of a sudden the plot stops until we emerge from the dungeon. That statement, of course, presumes there's a broader plot going on. But here we go. First off, a well-designed dungeon is more interesting to play through. It's really that simple. Your players will have more fun if you put some thought and you put some careful design into the dungeon. Secondly, a well-designed dungeon adds to your story rather than taking away from it, and we're going to come back to that one in detail. Third, a well-designed dungeon can draw players in on a story or character level instead of just being a place they mechanically wander through. I know I have, and I'm going to presume everyone, at least hosting, has been in that dungeon where, quite frankly, at some point, you really just don't give a damn anymore.
The endless series of rooms filled with endless series of traps and puzzles and monsters.
Yeah,
and
the corridor goes left or right. Which do you go? And you flip a coin.
Do I have a torch?
Yeah, you flip a coin, you shrug your shoulders, you roll a die, left, fine, I really don't care. Well, it's left or right? Where do you go? Right this time, why not? And it'd be great if you could design a dungeon that would draw your characters in, or draw your players in, and keep them interested. And fourth, well, this is kind of a side note, if your group prefers games that are just dungeon crawls, if you're into the clear and loot, clear and loot, clear and loot sort of game, and you're,
wow, that's boring.
To us, yeah, to me.
Well, you know, actually, I have to admit, and I've said this before, I actually kind of like that in an MMO. I want it automated. I want to be playing with friends. I want there to be nice, pretty explosions.
Yeah, I can even enjoy it in a tabletop RPG in limited doses. But I think for someone who's playing that type of game, where plot and characters really take a backseat to the dungeon crawl experience, I think some of the information this episode is going to be useful. Some of it's probably going to sound like overthinking to you because it just never mattered in the first place. All right. First thing I would recommend in figuring out a dungeon is, what is its out-of-character purpose?
Why did someone build a gigantic maze, fill it with spike traps just to live in?
That's its in-character purpose.
Oh.
What's its out-of-character purpose? Why are you as a game master putting this in the game at all? If your only answer is to fill time,
I was going to say fluff.
Yeah, precisely. If your only answer is fluff, or because it's D&D, you just feel like you have to throw it in there somewhere.
Got to be a dungeon. Got to be a dragon.
Yeah. Maybe don't. Maybe come up with something better. I mean, if you just didn't have time that week because of some drama in your life and you just wanted to have something for your characters to do, and going into this, your players understand it's just a little bit of fluff, kill some monsters, get some treasures, drink some beer, don't take it too seriously, that's fine. But what we're talking about here is the out of character purpose. Why are you taking the player characters in there? Now, here's a couple thoughts, and you guys feel free to throw on your own. I don't think these are mutually exclusive. One is to be entertained by the encounters and puzzles themselves. In other words, the adventure is the exploration. That your group really has fun going from room to room, searching for traps, clearing the monsters, looting the treasure. So the point is just to look around. Second possibility is to escape as quickly as possible. You just broke out of jail. This is a town filled with zombies, and you're trying to get to the car at the other end of town.
Did the zombies put me in jail?
Yeah.
Wow. That
happens. Why didn't they just eat you?
Did I get a trial? I mean, why am I trying to break out?
This is zombie law, Chad.
Oh, zombie law. Dude, yeah. That's not fair.
No.
It's either eat your brains or eat your brains.
Exactly.
The third is to get something and get out, meaning this would be a big one, like in something like Shadowrun.
Yeah.
You're trying to sneak in, you're trying to get the data core, you're trying to get out of there.
Just a smash and grab.
It's a smash and grab. There's a single objective you're after, you got to find. Or to sneak through completely unnoticed. You know, I think the one I didn't put in here is the clear, that your goal is simply to kill everything down there.
Kill more monsters, get more stuff.
Well, maybe not even get more stuff. Maybe just these caves are a gathering ground for a building goblin army. Your job is to get in there and kill the goblins before they...
See, to me, that right there is an exercise in a really long, complex word problem. It's just probability and statistics and algebra.
I'd add one more to your list, Dan. And I would say it would be a way to test character motivations and character behaviors, especially if you've got, you know, characters who may not necessarily in game statistics be very strong, but they're playing up the fact that they are so. You put them in the fire of combat because they're obviously going to run into some sort of combat in that dungeon. And then suddenly those attributes might come out, or the opposite of those things might come out, and then give the other player characters at the table, you know, a chance to either do some role-playing, calling that character out. Or it gives a chance for, you know, the hero to really fill that hero role that he very much wants to do. Whether it's, you know, trying to save someone or whether it's charging headlong into battle first, if your character is based around some sort of combat, you'll get that opportunity to do so in a dungeon. Now, granted, you shouldn't be doing that all the time, but it gives you an opportunity to explore certain avenues of character development.
I think it also gives the player characters each individually a chance to shine, or at least an opportunity to shine. And one of the things that I love to do in the dungeons I build, which doing primarily sci-fi, it's not dungeons in the typical sense. It'd be more things like abandoned starships and such. But you have the option of like, okay, there's the defense droid, so the guy in the powered armor with the pulse rifle's got to fight that. But, you know, maybe if you can get the hacker up to the control room, he can shut down all the defenses. Or the guy that's got the negotiation skill can try and talk the crazy hermit that's taken up residence in the ship to let them through some of it. And as a game master...
Why is there a crazy hermit on my starship?
Well, great question. And you know what? That's what you as a game master should be trying to figure out, those. It's
not even a stowaway. Well, it's a hermit.
But just like any other sort
on
of...
On my ship!
Just like any other sort of situation in roleplay, I'd say make sure that there's an opportunity for everyone in the party to get involved.
Including the crazy hermit.
Mm-hmm. And along those lines, make sure your dungeon is designed to enable the best fun within that kind of experience, okay? So, for example, if you're trying to design a dungeon where the purpose is a smash and grab, then make sure that the dungeon makes sense for a smash and grab, all right? Make sure that what they're after is in some place that's a little bit far in, it's not right by the door. Make sure that there's a couple different ways they can get to it. Make sure there's some interesting things they can encounter along the way.
When you design any kind of dungeon for any kind of purpose, should there be just one way, like just one way in, one way out, one way to achieve the objective? Yep. I mean, how obviously, you know, in saying that, it's like, well, no, of course not. You should, you know, open it up and let the players decide stuff. But how much of that should you define? How much of that should you just make the dungeon and you have a vague idea of what the players should do, you know, whatever the objective is, and let them figure it out? Maybe you'll learn it along the way. Or should you make a list of this is 10 ways to defeat this dungeon?
Yeah, I would cut you the middle road there. I think for variety's sake, and I really hate to speak in absolute, so I hate to say that you ought to do it this way or that way, but the way that I personally would do it is I would design the dungeon such that in a few cases, there might be obvious things I've written out where, okay, you can fight the golem that's blocking the door, or there's also a hidden door off here that maybe the thief can find along the way that'll let you bypass it. But I think really that's more of an execution thing, is you as a GM have to use some common sense about what the options are and be willing to go along with some solutions you didn't think of. Okay, there's a defense droid, but there's also a hacker who's got a military encrypted comm device, and maybe he can shut it down.
Mm-hmm.
Something else I'd suggest is to be sure to put in some interesting little tidbits that don't necessarily serve the main purpose of the dungeon. For example, some rooms might contain plot clues or references to the main plot going on. A room might have its own internal history. This is the place where some great king died, and here's a little bit of history on the great king. And maybe it's just interesting if you're a good story writer. If not, maybe there's a little puzzle or something surrounding it. Subplots. For example, maybe there's a captive that wants to escape, and you've got to make the decision. Do we take him with us, or is he just going to be extra baggage? Or is this actually crazy guy is going to start screaming in the middle of the hallway we're trying to sneak through? But find ways to weave your story, both your main story and the general setting, into the dungeon. Don't let the dungeon be this hard break from the game that was going on before entering and after exiting. Along those same lines, I would once again note the plot does not have to stop when the party enters the goblin-filled mine. NPCs can still betray you. You can stumble across notes. A captured messenger being held in one of the prison cells might reveal a major plot point about the king you're working for. I can't keep stressing this point enough. Don't let the plot stop once they enter the dungeon. There's a neat suggestion, and this one comes from our forum user, Citizen Joe. And it's kind of like creating a mind map, if you're familiar with those, for your dungeon. And we kind of lampoon those off the show, which is why Chad snickered a little. But I think actually in this case...
You love mind maps, admit it.
In this case, it's actually a pretty cool idea. But what he suggests is try a flowchart. What you do is you take a piece of paper, and in the middle of it, you write down the main purpose of the dungeon. Okay, this is the out-of-character reason why this dungeon's occurring in the plot. Then what you can start to do is just start brainstorming. It'd be really cool if he ran into this type of encounter, or it'd be really cool if I let slip this major plot point that the king they're working for is actually setting them up. Or it'd be really cool, here's this neat puzzle idea that I saw in a movie or read in a novel. And you start writing all those ideas on this piece of paper around that bubble. And then what you can start doing is you can start drawing lines that say, you know what, the goblin dungeon, and by dungeon I mean literal dungeon here as in like prison, would be a great place for them to find the captured messenger that's going to tell them about the king's plot. And suddenly you start connecting these, and the flow or the design of the dungeon may actually start to emerge from these out-of-character purposes. And I thought that was a really neat idea.
You know, that is actually a good idea. Because it really does answer that core question that I think, you don't really want to use the word experienced gamers, but those who've played for a little while and gotten over the initial fun of rolling and killing, you know, the main question everybody always asks when they're building it is why? Why is it here? Why is it here? And that really does go a ways to, you know, really helping to answer that question.
You know, right along those lines, I would also say know your group. Some groups love that kind of stuff. They love the exploration. They love sneaking around. They love trying to figure their way through the office building to do a smash and grab. Other groups just get bored and frustrated. And so I'd say, first of all, know your group's tastes in terms of the types of dungeons they would like. And secondly, also know their tolerance. I can't tell you how many D&D games I've been in where a third of the way through the dungeon, I just want out. And everyone else sitting, it's not just me, everyone else sitting at the table just wants out. And it just keeps going and going and going. And just like any other plot point, remember, nothing's set in stone until you've set it. If your group is starting to look bored or frustrated, throw in something to spice it up, just like you would any other plot point. If you can't throw in something to spice it up, guess what? The exit just appeared. The dungeon just happened to end right there in the middle of the bedroom.
It's always in the bedroom. It's the last place you always look.
So what is the purpose of a dungeon? That's what I'm kind of having my head wrap around, because when I run a role-playing game, I really don't put this much focus or emphasis on where the players are at and what is contained within that place.
I think perhaps where the mental disconnect is...
Well, where the mental disconnect is, every time you say dungeon, I could be thinking Star Trek, and you say dungeon, suddenly the bridge of the Enterprise turns into a stone cavern.
Yeah, and I realize I'm...
That is really hurting my mental image here.
Mappable, potentially non-combat environment, yeah, or something like that. It's just too long to say.
That's much more sexy, though.
Yeah. A spaceship is totally a dungeon. I get that. Because I think a map of a spaceship and you're the Star Trek Enterprise and you beam aboard this alien spaceship and you have no idea except the general shape of it. The scanners can't penetrate it. And you're going through and you're looking for this reason because your characters have these motivations. I mean, is that kind of what we're talking about here?
Yeah, I remember in the last Cyberpunk game that you ran, and it wasn't actually the Cyberpunk system, it was just the Cyberpunk setting. I remember that, and it did not end up happening, but there was an arcology.
Mm-hmm.
For anyone who's not familiar with the Cyberpunk genre, an arcology is like this great big corporate complex that has offices and residences, and it's kind of like you live where you work and you work where you live, and so it's just a huge mass of buildings. And we had all these different approaches of how we were going to sneak in there to try and bust out an artificial intelligence. Okay. But the point being, that's a dungeon. I think maybe where the mental disconnect is one, the word dungeon, like you said, it conjures up the meandering stone cavern. Yeah. But secondly is, you don't generally pre-map these.
No.
You're probably just going to wing it. Whereas a lot of people, myself included, when they would GM these, would have a map or at least kind of a rough sketch ready to go. But you have absolutely had dungeons in your games.
Yeah. Like I said, and I think that I post-map them. Because you're right, I just wing it as they're going through. But it's like the advice I gave on my GMing style, if anybody ever wants to try it. You don't necessarily make notes to take to the game. but you should take a couple of notes while you're running the game. They go into a bar and talk to the barkeep, and they really like the barkeep, and they're going to come back to him. Well, they're going to want to know, write down the guy's name, just one or two lines about him, whatever. So that when they come back 3 weeks later, you can look at it and go, oh yeah, same thing if they go to the quote dungeon or the building or the spaceship or whatever, as they're going through. And I think this applies even to people who don't have a sort of off-the-cuff style, who do plan things, because everybody ad-libs something in a game. I mean, unless you're reading verbatim out of a module, you're adding little touches and little details. Maybe the character's hooked on to something that you didn't think they would, or you don't have any information about, and you just make it up. Or they're halfway through, and you're just like, you know, it'd be really cool to add a crazy hermit who lives on the ship, who isn't a stowaway, and then...
Right.
Take little notes on that. And I don't know how you do that, if you do it like graphically or just notes in the margin of your line paper. I would just, personally, I wouldn't draw anything out. I just like write little notes on my own, but they'd be kind of geographic noun notes, person, places, or things.
There's another important point in there, which is that dungeons, generally speaking, are very heavily pre-planned, perhaps more pre-planned than anything else in your game, but that does not lock you into anything. That, like you said, Chad, if the characters walk into a room and they just latch onto something strange, there is nothing that stops you from ad-libbing it. Or if a really cool idea occurs to you that, man, it'd be neat to have this inscription on this king's casket that somehow implies something bigger about the things that are unfolding in the world, ad-lib it, write it down on a piece of notebook paper, keep it for consistency's sake, but don't hesitate to do it. All right, let's move from the out-of-character purpose to the in-character purpose. Things exist for a reason. Every one of us, at some point while playing a side-scrolling video game, has wondered how the hell Dr. Wily gets home at the end of the day.
And if he has an easier way through the death trap, monster-infested, 5-mile-long entrance to his home, why didn't you take that back door in? Which is actually kind of why they built the game Shadow of Colossus.
But nonetheless, yeah. All right, there's this point where, and this happens just as often in role-playing games, where the layout or the very existence of a dungeon seems rather senseless.
Pat, you've played a lot of D&D in your time.
I have.
What's the most senseless dungeon you've ever encountered?
I know of one. This dungeon is what made me completely hate and not want to be the sort of the scribe slash map person for the party, because it was a small group, just a couple of us playing, and somehow my friend said, you're going to draw the map, you're going to keep track of where the heck we're going. And the GM had made this dungeon up with his sister. He and his sister made it together. We had gone to hell. We were in one of the planes of hell, whatever, Hades, and it was a dungeon there. So it was this huge, elaborate, horrible thing, and it was going back on itself. It made absolutely no sense whatsoever. I mean, it's like it was a labyrinth. You get lost. Mm-hmm. That would be my worst one that I've ever been through. And it was horrible. And I think it's kind of like what you're saying, but I think in this instance, that was the point. The point of it was this dungeon was...
The point of it was to piss you off so you don't have fun.
Not to not have fun, but it was a purposely bad, horrible, horribly laid out, confusing dungeon.
Yeah.
A gentleman on our forums by the name of Skull Ossus.
Skull Ossus, like, you should get that looked at.
Yeah, it's like Colossus except Skull. Suggested starting it off this way. Where did this place come from? What person or process built it? And how should that affect the layout? Was this a castle that at some point was held by a king? Is this a wizard's tower? Is this a starship? Is this an office building? What was its purpose? Obviously, things are built according to their purpose. If you're going to build a castle, you're going to build it a certain way for certain reasons. It's not going to be a haphazard maze. All right, now, if the point of this is a Minotaur's maze to get you lost...
Somebody built a haphazard maze because they wanted one.
Yeah, because they wanted one. But start off with that. If it was artificially constructed, for what purpose was it constructed, and therefore how would it look logically? Now, one of the great things here is, guess what? People and natural processes have already figured out a lot of this for you. Use real examples for inspiration. If you want a cave, hop online, and look up cave maps.
Hey, the lazy GM, is the greatest advice he ever gave me is that if you want to do mapping for something, do like caves and caverns and whatnot, go to spelunking sites. They have all that crap already mapped out. Hundreds of them.
Similar thing. Look up castles, office buildings. Don't even have to find the floor plans for some of these. You probably work in an office building. Draw from that. Think of places you've been. This is something we're using in our current Skies of Glass game, but it was also suggested by Erasmus, so I'll give him credit as well. For cities, use Google Maps.
Oh, yeah.
Pick a random small town in America or a major metropolis, depending on your need, and scroll way into the street view, maybe even get the satellite view, and there you go.
Yeah.
You've got a great map of a logical city layout.
And never choose a city where you live, ever. Because all the players will start going, okay, well, we need to take this street, and this street to get to this location. Well, that's not there. That moved. It's on this other street. There's a shortcut you could take over there, and it's just like, you know, driving someplace in real life with your friends.
I was going to disagree with you there, because I actually played in a campaign where it was a modern-day setting. We played in our hometown, and I thought it was really cool because it brought a whole new perspective for me as a player in the game.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I know where we are. I mean, I liked it that way. And it didn't get to that semantics got to take this and that.
No, so I agree.
I completely disagree with you.
I had a game that I tried to run that was not only in our hometown of St. Louis, but in and around the apartment complex where I live.
Mm.
And my biggest problem was trying to make it real enough to be believable, yet alien enough to be different.
Mm.
And those two concepts sound very simple, but it caused a major disconnect for me. And I ended up making it boring, and so I had a failure.
Problem I've always found is people either, one, abuse their knowledge of a place, or secondly...
You have way too many abusers in your games. I think that's your biggest problem. It isn't that lack of imagination. You always say no. It isn't any of that. No, you've had a couple of really crappy gaming groups, and it's scarred you.
Maybe that's the problem.
Yeah,
I'm bitter and cynical.
Every time that something example comes up, you're just like, no, that's a bad idea because I've seen people abuse that. Abuse local knowledge? Aren't we here to have fun? Why are you abusing local knowledge?
Wow.
All right. Along those lines, David Gray suggested using Google Earth.
What's up, David?
For geologic or outdoor features.
Mm.
So, for example, if your dungeon happens to be the Valley of Mountain Range or
Valley of the Kings.
The Valley of the Kings or a forest or something like that, use Google Earth and look up something like that.
And I will say that if you're using realistic places, like, for instance, we played here in St. Louis, Google Maps and Google Earth has a fantastic feature. It puts a pin in a location where it's mentioned in a Wikipedia article. And if you turn that function on, wherever you're at that has somebody, and even a lot of places that don't have anybody, you will find dozens upon hundreds of Wikipedia articles that you can use to expand the flavor of the local area.
Along those lines, if you're playing in a more medieval or ancient setting, there's an increasing number of educational websites, and I wish I had one off the top of my head to list or put in the show notes, but that give models or maps of ancient or medieval cities.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can use those in the exact same way and then hit Wikipedia or Encyclopedia Britannica or whatever floats your boat to look up details on that city and learn about what those buildings were used for. And
I'm going to ask you guys a question about that, because I already know what my answer is. Can you use those resources, the models of ancient cities, the Wikipedia articles, Google Earth, Google Maps, if your game, or, well, dungeon in this case, does not exist on Earth in our times?
Yes, but... I think I think
if we're talking about a Klingon spaceship, yeah, there's a huge, gigantic disconnect.
Yeah, and I think here's the thing. Look at Hollywood movies. They film Hollywood movies where they do a great suspension disbelief that they're on some alien world or Middle Earth or whatever, And in truth, they're in Arizona or New Zealand or Alaska. And so I think, yes. Now, like you said, if you're on a Klingon warship, okay, now you're suddenly jumping into this wild speculation on... Now, I still think there's some sense and sensibility.
Yeah.
For example, there's going to be hallways and logical room arrangements, and the place should make sense. It should not be this weird, winding maze. But I think even for... If we're not talking about something that speculative, I still think, yeah, the Earth is perfectly useful, and you can look at exactly how Hollywood does it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we've talked about things relating to that, is that, you know, all fantasy, or even in a certain sense, even science fiction, is still grounded in some semblance of reality. And it's that reality base that everybody keys off of. And so, yeah, absolutely, you can and should use those things, use those resources. Because, you know, A, they're there, and B, they do provide a wealth of information that, even if you don't agree with some of it, it's very easy to change because you can kind of see how the whole structure works together, and you can make your modifications as you go.
Next three items, these all come from Skolossus. He's apparently quite the expert on dungeon design. So I'm going to list off, but the next several things I rattle off all come from him. First off, think about how its owner travels through the place, presuming it has one.
That's my biggest problem with, like, the sort of dungeon crawl dungeons. When you're talking about in a college, not even necessarily like this is the wizard's lair, because it could be like a crypt or something and they want to protect the bodies in sort of pyramid-esque sort of things where nobody's supposed to get to them anyway. But you're filling a dungeon with living creatures in an ecosystem. Well, if you have a group of kobolds in a singular hallway, and at the beginning of a hallway is a spike pit trap, and on the other side of the hallway is a flaming death trap. Have the kobolds lived in that 20-foot section of hallway no escape for their entire life?
We haven't gotten there yet, but I've got a whole section on monster ecology.
Yeah.
But if it's something like, let's say you have a dungeon where it's this long, winding maze of spike pits and flame traps and wild monsters that no one can control, and some crazy asshole lives in the back. Once again, how does Dr. Wily get home at night?
You know, Order of the Stick made a good joke about that, where the evil lord had a dungeon, right? A lair, massive, huge lair that he had abandoned, and he hadn't been there in years and years, and their old one was destroyed. So they decided to go, you know, it's like, okay, we need to crack open the old lair. And they cracked it open. They're like, oh no, it's filled with monsters. And they're like, well, isn't that a good thing? Isn't that what they want? And he's like, no, we're bad guys. It was a bad lair. It's filled with good guy monsters, angels and centaurs and all that stuff. Now we got to clear this whole place out.
Along those lines, and this may be a great way to also make sure that all of the skills or skill sets within your player characters get used, is ask yourself questions like, how do they get around their own traps? Mm-hmm. Now, once again, Che, like you said, if this is a pyramid type crypt that's meant to keep everybody out,
man pulls the last lever and that's
all
it.
Set, maybe that's not an issue. But if this is a castle that something still lives within, how does it get past its own traps? Is there a hidden passageway? Is there a kill switch? Is there a string that you just have to know is there and step over?
I'm curious, has there ever been any example in real history where they've made some sort of tomb or treasure room or something like that that is guarded by tons of traps? And I don't mean like, yeah, in Switzerland, there's a bank vault that's surrounded by lasers. I'm talking like an Indiana Jones type.
Yeah,
thing.
There are. Once again,
the traps work. Alan Quartermain. And
that's part of the problem is a lot of these traps don't work just because time decays so many of their components.
Right.
But yeah, there are real places like that.
Where?
Egypt, China.
Because the pyramids didn't have death traps in them.
No, not generally speaking, but yeah, there were some places,
like fake rooms
where yeah, you open this and something would start flooding with sand. Or in China, they found one that I think had like all these like crossbows set up or something like that. And
cool.
Yeah. And I think most of it didn't work
sure.
because it was so, it had all decayed to nothing. But I if you'd asked me this off show, I actually probably would have looked some of this up, but the short answer is yes.
I want to see examples of this.
Still,
that's so cool.
Still continuing with Skolossus' stuff. Think about how the owner or creator uses the place. Okay. If they're just trying to hide bodies and treasure there, it's going to look one way. But if this is their lair,
hide bodies and treasure. It's like, that's where they shove the dead prostitutes and blow.
You got to have a hobby.
For example, if a wizard lives down there, does he have a bedroom?
With dead prostitutes and blow.
Does he have a bathroom?
I'll stop.
Yeah.
Would he put the bedroom right next to the lab where he's playing with rotting, decaying corpses?
Well, hell yeah.
But think about it. If this was your place, okay, you're building this with a purpose in mind, which we've gotten to higher up in the in-character purpose, make this place make logical sense. And that's one of my biggest beefs with so many dungeons and so many things, video games, role-playing games, whatever, is the fact that the dungeons just make no damn sense. No one in their right mind would build this place. No one in their right mind would inhabit this place. The purpose is clearly for the sake of having an adventuring party go through, fight monsters, and face traps. And that, if that's your game, that's what you want out of a game. There's nothing wrong with that. But I would challenge you, and I think most people listen to this show, that's probably not their flavor of game, because if that is, I don't know how much you're getting out of this show, but
most people's flavor of game is more of a hazelnut pecan.
Fair enough. But what I would challenge you to do is to really think about,
how much work should you put into that? Because I am with you 100%. I hear what you're saying. But what if I'm a game master and my gaming group really doesn't care about that sort of thing? I think that there should be a certain amount of still logic that you put into it, because I think the human mind, even the players who don't care, subconsciously, they're kind of looking at it, and I think subconsciously it might have an effect on them a little bit negatively. But if you have a bunch of players who just don't give a crap about that sort of thing, maybe they're into the story. Maybe they're into their characters. Maybe they're just into killing monsters and getting loot. Perhaps you shouldn't focus much of your efforts.
I'd say is if your players don't care, there's one of two things that's going to
horribly. Well, maybe they care about other things.
Is either one, this dungeon shouldn't be there,
mm-hmm.
period. Or two,
well, it shouldn't be there. I mean,
you need to find a way to make it appealing to them.
Well, what if it's there because the players want it to be there, but they just don't care about whether or not the wizard's bathroom is next to his corp grinder or something.
You know what? Even if they don't care about those particular details, adding them in, even if it's just an incidental mention, it adds that sense of realism and it helps complete that sense of immersion. Yeah, the wizard's bathroom really doesn't matter, but having it there, there's always going to be at least someone at the table who's always thinking, where does he take a crap? You know, come on, where's the shitter? So having that there answers that guy's question. So that one player or two players, suddenly now they feel you've made their interest because you've added that level of detail.
I say, I'm going to agree with Chris that I think part of what's going on here is if they just don't care at all, then maybe it shouldn't be in there. But if they care enough that they want to go in there, I really think the challenge for you as a game master is to make them care about the place, to make the place so interesting, so vibrant, to do such a good job of describing it, of laying it out, of making it sensible, of having this progressing plot where suddenly the place is interesting to me.
I agree with you guys. Personally, I agree with you guys because I love the little details and such, but it just seems to me that you can have a type of game where you go all through the dungeon and fix the puzzles and take out the traps and take care of the monsters, and then you get to the wizard in his lab with his corpse grinder, which just really freaks me out for some reason, and he is like shooting lightning bolts and he's your father and he's flying around on a manticore and all this crazy stuff, and then he's dead and they're arguing over which character gets his boots. Nobody cares about the bathroom. I mean, it's I think there's groups out there like that.
Yeah, and there are. And this is some of us is you have to know how to cater to the group. Yeah. I mean, I think I could have.
Then you got to put his secret stash of porn in the wizard's bathroom to get somebody to care.
Now I care about the bathroom.
Yeah.
See,
yeah.
There you go. See?
You got to know how to motivate your players. That's another question that's kind of off of that. So you put in all of this, I don't want to call it fluff, because it's right. It adds personality, it adds right. depth. Again, I agree with you guys, and I would totally put all this stuff in there. How much attention should you draw to that, if any? I mean, because if you start saying, look, bathroom, gold-plated fixtures, look at that, there's a whole pile of cocaine on the toilet seat. Suddenly the characters are going to start caring maybe in the wrong ways about the bathroom. Maybe they're going to search it for traps and do all this other stuff.
Well,
when in reality, it's just a piece of fluff.
Avoiding too many search rules is something that I'm going to get to a little bit further down, so bear with me on that one. But, you know, I don't know what to say except that I would deal with it the same way I would anything else in a plot. I mean, we've told the bookstore story before. Mm-hmm. And it's the same kind of thing that people just latch on to weird stuff.
Yeah.
But I think
maybe you should make it important.
Yeah. Make it important, or at least
it is a bathroom full of cocaine.
Well, I mean, or at least kind of nudge to your players and say, you know, look, my desire here is to make a more interesting, more believable experience. Here's these great descriptions. Maybe you can learn something about the wizard's personality by the way the bathroom's decorated or which particular dark god he worships or something like that. But in the end, you kind of, you know, just nudge him out that, look, mm-hmm. this is just a bathroom and there's no flush trap.
Technically, there is a trap in that bathroom. There's a toilet.
I think the important thing there is just that you have planned for it. You have had, you know, you've mm-hmm. taken the time to have that complete dungeon. With this bathroom example, I mean, I think we've beat this into the ground, but with the bathroom, it's not
the boot. We have not yet begun to beat this bathroom.
It's not so much that you've got this big descriptor for the bathroom mm-hmm. or you're even anticipating them finding it. It's just like you had mentioned, if you've got that one, you know, character that goes, hey, where's this guy go to the bathroom? Then you can say, well, if you want to look around, okay, roll some dice. Oh, well, you happen to find a room that apparently is the bathroom.
Yeah.
So it's there, it's on the map, and boom, you took that time. You put that effort into it. It's not that you have to bring a huge description into the game.
Well, and while this may not figure directly into the bathroom thing, I think something else you're doing is the more logic you put to a place, in addition to the immersion, believability, something else I think you're doing is lowering frustration, because the majority of environs that you're going to enter into are not frustrating mazes.
You know what? Maybe instead of like all these online tools for mapping and castles and caves and stuff, there should be an online searchable database of fluff. Somebody asks you, it's like, oh man, where does this guy take a crap at? And then you have your laptop out and like, well, hold on a second. You know, and then you type into the searchable database, medieval, magical, bathroom, boom. And it pulls it like, it's like with those pirate name generators. It pulls in different keywords you search and then it generates this fluff text of a bathroom or a kitchen or, you know, whatever. And you can like make it really weird, or you can put a weirdness level on it and stuff like that.
You know what? We actually still have a ton to go here on dungeon building. So I think we are going to do a two-parters in a row.
Wow.
Oh my gosh.
So
asymmetrical.
I hate to leave this one kind of hanging right here, but we are going to go ahead.
We're
going to
go ahead and do number two on the Wizard's Bathroom.
We're going to do a number two of
Wow.
So, we will come back next week with the second part of the dungeon building series, and the episode this coming week should drop right on time, so actually you should see it in just a couple days, so this episode should still be pretty fresh on your mind when you hear that one. So you guys take care, and we will catch you next time.
Later.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2009. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.